Now, on this edition of Heard in Central Florida, hear Seminole County Representative Scott Plakin and Jason Broder and Seminole County Senator David Simmons report on the outcome of the 2012 session of the Florida Legislature.
The two biggest issues that we were dealing with this year, though, the 800-pound gorillas in the room, so to speak, would be the budget and redistricting.
From Carol McKinney Public Media, this is Heard in Central Florida, presenting more local issues and voices that matter.
Support for Heard in Central Florida is made possible in part by the Friends of Carol McKinney, who encourage you to make a tax-deductible gift in support of the programming activities of Carol McKinney Foundation for Public Media.
Hello, I'm Desta Horner for CMF Public Media. Welcome to Heard in Central Florida, where you will hear three members of the Seminole County Legislative Delegation as they review the actions taken by the Florida Legislature in the 2012 session, which ended in March. These individual presentations by the lawmakers will last a total of 25 minutes. It will be followed by a 16-minute period of responses to questions from the audience. First, you will hear Representative Scott Plakin comment on the budget, redistricting, and the comprehensive energy program for the state. Next, Senator David Simmons gives a detailed update of education funding and education policy. Finally, you will hear Representative Jason Broder comment on the reform of Workforce Florida and job creation. This legislative forum was recorded at the luncheon meeting of the Oviedo Winter Springs Chamber of Commerce on April 6, 2012. Before each legislator speaks, he will be introduced by Regina Bereswell.
Representative Plakin was reelected to his second term in the Florida House of Representatives in November 2010, where he currently serves as chairman of the Energy and Utilities Subcommittee and as a member of the Congressional Redistricting Business and Consumer Affairs, Civil Justice, Rules and Calendar, and State Affairs Committees. Representative Plakin is a well-regarded local businessman. Welcome, Representative Plakin.
I'll briefly go just an overview of generally what we did this session. Despite where the national economy is and a lot of the concerns of Floridians, again this year, the highest priority of the legislature was jobs and the economy. And I know all of us have appreciated the leadership of the governor, the jobs governor, in helping to put forth policies towards this. The two biggest issues that we were dealing with this year, though, the 800-pound gorillas in the room, so to speak, would be the budget, where we had, again this year, after a $4 billion shortfall last year, another $1.8 billion shortfall again. Of course, this is very, very difficult work, and particularly Senator Simmons, I know, is chair of the Education Appropriation, especially his job is particularly difficult. But I'm sure he'll talk about this more. We were able to add over $1 billion to education this year, which that I would consider one of our highest duties in the state of Florida is to make sure we provide a bright future for our kids through our education system. So I think all of us are particularly proud of that. The other thing with the budget, what we're able to do is to balance our budget as we're constitutionally required without raising taxes or fees. And that is no simple task, I could tell you. If you look at us in comparison to some other states of what they've done, I could not be more proud of what we've done this year. In fact, I said, I think on the House floor, the proudest vote that I had this year, despite some of the bills that I have, was on the budget. If you look at Illinois, who on their last day of their legislative session raised corporate and personal income taxes by more than 50%. Illinois has lost 100,000 jobs in the last year when they did this. We have gained over 100,000 jobs. You look at other irresponsible states like California and New York. Here in Florida, last year, we actually are one of now a handful of states have maintained our AAA bond rating, which saves hundreds of millions of dollars in interest that can be used for other priorities. So it's particularly telling if you look at the responsibility level, let's say, of other legislatures compared to Florida, I could not be more proud of our work. In terms of the other 800-pound gorilla was redistricting. As you can probably see in the papers over the last year, there was numerous groups that came out and challenged the work that we did. Of course, there's a number of us that opposed Amendments 5 and 6, back before they were voted on. But the minute they became part of our Constitution in the state of Florida, we all took an oath to uphold the Constitution. And I'm very proud to say that's exactly what we did in drawing these maps. The House maps went through the Supreme Court. The Senate maps, we had to go back. I'm hopeful that this time around the new with the amendments will be approved. And the congressional, of course, there's lawsuits on all of these. I'm hopeful that those will get done as well in a timely fashion. But last summer, when we were going around the state getting more citizen input than I would venture to say than any state has ever done on their maps, in the most open and transparent process perhaps ever in the United States, the criticism was very intense from a lot of groups. So if you look at the criticism then and what has happened now, I'm very, very proud of what we've done. And even though certain parts we disagreed with it, we've fulfilled our constitutional responsibility. I'll just mention a few of my own priorities. The Internet cafe infestation, I call it, is a big problem in our state. There's about 1,000 of these, including about 7 in Seminole County. I'm happy to say that Seminole County has been looked upon favorably both by the Circuit Court and the Appeals Court, the Federal Appeals Court. There was a lawsuit against Seminole County. So as of now, they're going to start fining these locations for violating our ordinance, and it goes to court next January. Meanwhile, the Florida House this year passed the prohibition on this illegal slot machines in our neighborhoods. It was something like 74-30-some, the vote. And I want to thank Representative Broder for your help on that bill. Of course, this is a team effort when you talk about confronting $1 billion, what I consider a rogue industry. And Senator Simmons in the Senate was really helpful, being brilliant, you know, as a very brilliant lawyer, because there's some complexities with this. So I will be filing that bill again next year, and hopefully we can move it in the Senate. What we did accomplish is during this session, the Florida Chamber is actively engaged. In fact, they double-counted that vote on their scorecard for legislators this year. And the entire Florida cabinet, the governor, the attorney general, the CFO, and the ag secretary, all unanimously put out a press release in support of clarifying the law and banning these rogue gambling operations. So next year, I hope I'm wrong, but history will probably serve right, the crime and problems that come along with these, it'll be even a stronger case, and hopefully we can get it through the Senate next year. I also want to thank Senator Simmons. We passed a bill related to stalking, and I'll let him talk about that. But a lot of the bills in the House, the senators are so busy, a lot of times I've taken the lead, but I'll let you talk about that. But we work very closely together on that, and you can, I guess, talk about the details. The cap and trade bill that put in under Governor Crist that would expose the state to extraordinary cost if fully implemented. I filed House Bill 401 that repealed the cap and trade bill. It should be on its way to the governor. I had another bill that prohibits the use of, believe it or not, people don't realize when you believe this, that EBT cards, the welfare cash cards, you can take out your welfare cash at liquor stores, at gambling establishments, including Internet Cafe sweepstakes place, and, yes, at strip clubs. So I had House Bill, this bill went through the House, and it didn't make it through the last night of the Senate, so I hope to bring that back next year. Cayley's Law, myself and Representative Diaz filed that, I think, the day after the verdict. It did pass with a much toned-down version of it, but that went through, I believe, the last week of a session as well. And on that one, we waited till after the verdict before filing the bill so we could see the thing play out, just to note that. Probably the biggest thing that in terms of individual responsibilities that I had this year is I was honored that the Speaker appointed me to chair the Energy and Utility Subcommittees of the House. And we have, awaiting the governor's signature now, the first comprehensive energy bill that has been passed since 2008. There's been groups for and against contacting the governor, but I'm hopeful that he'll sign this into law so we can, in a comprehensive way, address our energy needs. So, and again, thank you for inviting me, and I look forward to getting to know more of you since my district now will be right in this area.
David Simmons is the state senator for District 22, serving Orange and Seminole counties. He took office on November 3, 2010. David is chair of the Senate Budget Subcommittee on Education, Pre-K through 12 Appropriations. He is a member of the Committees on Budget, Agriculture, Budget Subcommittee on Higher Education Appropriations, Judiciary and Rules Subcommittee on Ethics and Elections. He is also a Republican Major Whip. David was a member of the Florida House of Representatives from 2000 through 2008. From his experience in the House, David gained expertise in a broad spectrum of issues that are important in our state. The Orlando Sentinel consistently rated David Simmons as one of the most effective legislators in Central Florida.
As Representative Plakin has pointed out to you, we certainly dealt and had a lot of time taken up with respect to redistricting. We had a tremendous amount of time spent with respect to the budget. But I want to talk about a specific part of the budget, and that's the education budget, because it's so important to all of us. And we have a great education system here in Seminole County, and we really have a great education system compared to the rest of the nation. As a matter of fact, in 1998, when Governor Bush was elected, what happened is that Florida was really at the bottom of the pile. We were at the bottom of the heap when you're talking about education. And we were someplace in the lower part of the states if you compared us. But with the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate, in the last 12 years, we have now become one of the best education, pre-K through 12 systems in the nation. And Education Week is a very highly revered, independent arbiter of the best school systems in the nation. You know, last year they rated us fifth in the nation. This year they rated us 11th in the nation. But we are clearly at the top of the school systems in the nation. There's no doubt about that. As a matter of fact, the state of Florida is looked at as one of the leaders that that they seek to really emulate when you're talking about education. That doesn't mean that we don't have some tremendous challenges. We've had tremendous challenges in the last few years with respect to education funding. It's very frustrating to me because I want very much for there to be, not only sufficient but ample education funding here in the state of Florida. Now, we have to also keep that in perspective, keep it in the perspective that other states have slashed their education pre-K through 12 and higher education budgets tremendously. When you're talking about having a $35 billion deficit like California, you're talking about heading towards bankruptcy. I mean, there are other states that are really, really teetering on bankruptcy while the state of Florida is fiscally sound. So we know that we are, while at the top of the ratings in the nation, that's not sufficient because the school systems in the nation have to compete globally. And so I spent the last 2 years working first to make sure that there's adequate funding for education, and this year, obviously, we were able to add an additional $1 billion. That's not good enough for me. It's not good enough for any one of us here. But I can tell you in these difficult times, it was a tremendous, tremendous accomplishment. Now, another thing that we've done in education this year with the funding that we were able to do is that we know that those children who are the at-risk children, those who are in the D and F schools, those in which, believe it or not, when you have a D or F school in the state of Florida, that by the time you do the count of students in the October count, that 50% of them are not even there in the January or February count. We're talking about a tremendous challenge that we have, and these children who are in DNF schools need to catch up because these are the same children that have been shown that do not perform when they get into the third grade FCAT test, and we know that they're behind then, and they never catch up. And those are the same children who, by the time that they get into the 9th and 10th and 11th grades, drop out, And they're the same ones who are unemployed. Many of them are minorities. And then the next thing happens is they're in jail, costing us $25,000 a year. And the reason they're in jail is because they've committed a crime. And there are a number of crimes they commit before they ever get caught. And that's the cost to society, to all of us. So what we did this year is the House and the Senate have passed a budget that allocates $30 million to all of the DNF elementary schools where it has shown that if we actually add an extra hour a day, if we add an extra hour a day of intense reading instruction, that it makes tremendous, tremendous differences in these children's lives. We believe that we're going to make a dramatic change in education here in the state of Florida by doing that. The studies have shown, and we did a pilot program back in 2008 and found that schools, that were elementary schools that had D's and F's, some of them went from F's to A in 1 year. Massachusetts is a leader in this area, and they're acknowledged to be the number one school system in the nation. And they strongly believe in taking these children who are at risk and giving them the extra hour a day because, as Thomas Jefferson said, the harder I work, the luckier I seem to get. Well, it's not luck. We know that what happens is that good, hard work makes a big difference. And giving these children that extra hour a day of intense reading permits them to catch up. And we're going to hope that with doing this, we're going to change the way the education system is here in the state of Florida, because those children who are at risk, they don't only hurt themselves. They hurt all the other children who are with them, and they also ultimately hurt society. But most of all, we have to care for them. So we're doing that. We're making a big difference. We're making reforms that continue to improve the education system here in the state. The early learning, the birth to age 5, we have at-risk students. There are about 500,000 of these children who we're able to take care of about 250,000 of these. But one thing is sure, that our early learning system was more of a system that was made for basically, I won't use the word warehousing these children, but we weren't emphasizing teaching these children because these are the same at-risk children who end up being behind and ultimately falling behind their whole lives. We've gone ahead and we've changed. We've dramatically reformed the early learning system here in the state of Florida with legislation this year to demand testing, pre-testing, and post-testing, and emphasizing that these children need to be taught rather than just simply babysat. We understand that our children are an investment not only in them, but in our communities and in our futures. So I'm really, really pleased to say to you that we've made this difference this year, and we're going to keep trying to reform education to make our system not only the best in the nation, which it's close to being right now, but the best in the world. Thank you.
Our own Representative Broder worked for Procter & Gamble for nearly 12 years and then started his own local health care consulting business headquartered in Sanford, Florida. He was elected to the Florida House of Representatives in 2010. Since elected, Representative Broder has been a member of a number of committees, including the Health and Human Services Committee, Finance and Tax Committee, Transportation and Economic Development Appropriations Subcommittee, Pre-K through 12 Appropriations Subcommittee, Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee, and is currently the Vice Chair of the Business and Consumer Affairs Subcommittee. Representative Broder is also the chairman of the Seminole County Legislative Delegation. Welcome, Representative Jason Broder.
I've got to quit going last. Everybody says all the good stuff before they get to me. As this is a chamber and it hasn't been covered quite in depth yet, what I'll choose to talk a little bit about is the last couple years' worth of job creation that we've been doing. I brought these poster boards over here that you all can see to your right to kind of demonstrate what it is we've been focused on in the big picture and what our results are of it. It's one thing to get up and campaign and say, you're for improving the economy and doing jobs. Well, what did we do? Well, what you can see there from that chart on the left is the chart of how many jobs are being created in the state of Florida. One of the things that we did last year was we deregulated a number of different industries that were keeping people from either starting or expanding their businesses. We've tackled unemployment compensation, and this year, I think my biggest bill, the one I'm most proud of, was a bill to reform Workforce Florida. As has been reported for the last year or so, there are 24 regional workforce boards around the state of Florida who are tasked with taking federal and state dollars and helping people get back to work. Those that want a job need someplace they can go to say, I'm available, here are my skills, can you find a job for me? And the state of Florida provides that through our regional workforce boards. Well, we had seen some questionable spending of some of those tax dollars over the last several years or so. In fact, since 2003, 16 of those 24 boards have been cited for misfeasance or malfeasance. Anything from what you heard at the Central Florida Regional Workforce Board of buying capes with the money because they wanted people to make sure they knew they were capable, rather than job training or skill assessment, they were buying capes for people. That, I don't think, is the most egregious of all the examples. We did have a workforce board that had the spouse of one of the directors giving massages to other members at $6,000. I think there were $14 cupcakes handed out. Long story short is that through all of these things that have happened over the last several years, there really needed to be some reform. The way the law was written, there was only one course of action, and that was what we called the nuclear option. The governor could get rid of the entire board. And these workforce boards are made up of maybe 2 to 3 dozen of our business leaders who are hardworking, well-meaning, really the good people that we need on the boards. If they had 1 or 2 bad actors, the governor had no recourse but to fire the whole board. So a bill that I did this year did a number of things to reform our Workforce Florida system so that we can start using those agencies as the vehicle that they are to help get people back to work. First thing we did was we allowed for the governor to remove people for cause individually. Didn't have to remove the whole board at once. If you had 1 or 2 bad actors, you could pull them out. Second thing we did is all the folks that are going to serve now have to file a Form 1, instead of which is a financial disclosure form. It's not nearly as invasive as I would say the Form 6 is that we as elected officials have to fill out, but it does give the public some assurance that people aren't on that board to pad their relatives' pockets. One of the things we did is that we also said that if you are going to, as a workforce board, hire a relative of one of the members for something, it's okay. You just have to disclose it and get a 2/3 vote. You may be in a community where your brother or your mother is the only one in town. That's fine. But we can't have that as a vehicle for making sure that the taxpayer dollars aren't being spent as effectively as possible. And one of the last things we did is we closed a loophole. Over a certain spending threshold, you have to get approval from the state of Florida in order to spend that as an agency. And there were many boards that were filing invoices that were partial payments over a course of months, so they didn't have to get approval, that eventually added up to the big total. We stopped that and added that as a reason for cause termination. So that said, the governor was in town last week to sign the bill. Very proud of that. And what that's netted for us is an increase in jobs, a continual increase in jobs. In fact, in January, February, and March of this year, for which we have whole numbers, we're adding about 30,000 jobs a month now through this system, and there are many more jobs that are available on that system. So I think between regulatory reform and reform of even the government's impact on job creation, we're doing all the things that we said we were going to do. You can see that what that's netted us in a bigger picture as the chart on the right is that our unemployment rate has dropped more than twice as fast as the national unemployment rate. We're actually down 2.1 points versus the national 0.9. So we are having a big impact. I think all the changes we're making are having a big change for us in the state of Florida. We're actively trying to get businesses to move here, to expand here, to make sure we're the number one destination for people to come and either add a business, add on to their business, or start their business. Another thing I worked on this year that I'm proud of is regarding water and wastewater utilities. Chairman Plakin was kind enough to hear the bill. We had a problem out, and still have, a problem out in Chuliota with our investor-owned water suppliers. And sometimes you hear about that customers are being charged an exorbitant amount of money for a quality of water that they don't find acceptable. I had proposed a bill that would help address that, and through a number of the things I wanted to do and working with staff, found out that some of them were confiscatory, some of them were not constitutional, but eventually got to a place where we have a study commission that is going to address investor-owned utilities in the state of Florida so that we can get some relief for the people in Chuliota. I think it's a good first step. I think it's our first legislative attempt to fix the problem, which has plagued the folks for years, and there are a number of issues out there, environmental, in addition to operator. So we want to get to the bottom of that. And there are a lot of professionals in the state of Florida who I think are going to be appointed to the board that will be able to help address that and solve that. I think everybody deserves to have quality water at an affordable rate. And if there are members of the community that aren't getting that, we need to address it. And I think that's what we're going to do. I think we've all mentioned redistricting, and that took up a good amount of time. This past year, very pleased with the job that the House did and those things that I was able to help with. One of the things in redistricting that was very challenging, as Representative Plakin mentioned, was from my side on congressional, was Amendment 6. We have to, when we were drawing the maps, adhere to not only the Federal Voter Rights Act, but Amendment 6 as well. And I think I mentioned at one of my last chamber meetings, that puts an enormous amount of constraints on what we do when we draw maps. The first thing we have to do is draw minority-majority seats. In the state of Florida, there are five of them, with a sixth one that was 48%. And every seat has to have 696,345 people, give or take one. Not 1%, not one precinct, not one street, not one household, one person. And so when you start layering on all the constraints that are happening, it made for a very, very challenging exercise. We will see when we hear back from the Department of Justice whether or not those stick. As was mentioned, there are lawsuits there. But I'm proud of the work we did there as well. After that, I think we'll open it up for questions.
I have the mic.
All right. There we go.
Anyone have any questions?
I'm Tom Wolf, San Mara's management. And I want to know if there's any kind of legislation in the pipeline that's going to address any of the banks and their ability to fall under this safe harbor provision, to where they only pay 1% or 12 months of the association fees if and when they take title to the property. So, and part two of the question would be, is there any way that the legislation can be enacted to force these banks to take title to the property faster? We have so many homes that are in foreclosure limbo. They could be there for 2 or 3 years, 4 years, and a bank will never take title to it because it's an expensive proposition for the bank.
Yes, and that is a serious problem, and we addressed it in the legislature this year. There were various ways of trying to address it. One of them had to do with the time period that banks would be responsible, and obviously that set up the associations, the community associations against the banks. There was a dispute there. There was a knowledge that the banks need to move forward on these cases because as long as they keep them in limbo, we have injury to neighborhoods, tremendous injury. And of course, the question is, why are the banks taking so long? They blame the court system in many respects. In my conversations with the judges, they said it wasn't so much the court system, it was more of the banks who just wouldn't move the cases. And so we ultimately resolved this by allocating an additional $4.5 million to funding for the court system so that they can hire retired judges to get these cases moving. And that means that the judges are committed to the fact that they're not going to just wait on the banks to just let them sit and vegetate. They're going to actually set them for trial and force them to get through. And so we have addressed that in a way that it would not deny due process to people, because there were arguments about going ahead and changing the foreclosure laws and try to do foreclosures outside of the court system and that way potentially deny those persons who were defendants the ability to contest them as easily. But we are going to make sure that the court system moves promptly in order to adjudicate these cases.
Other questions?
Hi, my name is Annette again. I have a question in regards to the program that y'all plan to do for education, putting in an hour of intense reading. I am from Brooklyn, New York. I grew up in a low-income environment where they implemented something back then similar. But in addition to that, to couple with it, they had a lot of activities for kids, which helped them be more motivated to go to school, which helped them be more motivated to actually want to read more, because they knew that if they couldn't get the grades up, they couldn't be active, they couldn't be part of the programs. So I was just wondering, because I noticed I had kids who went to the elementary schools here, and there's very little physical activity for them. So I was wondering if there's any plans in the future to incorporate something like that, because especially with us being in fitness, we can tell you the benefits, besides the health benefits, is more positive attitude, people more motivated, more happier. So I was just wondering if they're planning to do something like that in coupling with the intensive reading.
I can tell you that we have passed legislation, and that was probably 3 years ago, about requiring the schools to have a physical fitness program. We use about, average in the nation is about 1,080 hours of school per year. That's 9 months with about six or whatever it is hours a day. And the fact of it is that other developed nations, such as, in Europe, they go from 1,200 hours a year to 1,400 hours a year. They're getting ahead of us. We're falling behind. And so we need to be able, as we've done here with respect to these DNF schools this year, is have that extra hour a day so that they can be taught the information. You know, trying to get the amount of information necessary into these at-risk children is like trying to put 25 pounds of sugar in a 10-pound sack. You just can't do it. So that's the reason they need more time to do this. And when we have more time, I really believe that it's going to expand, and I believe that you're going to find more time for physical education as we ultimately do, like St. John's County has done, is they have all of their students go an extra hour a day. And that extra hour a day was actually taken away back in the 1990s due to budget cuts. We should be sending all of our children an extra hour a day. They'll have time for phys ed at that time.
Question.
You know, it's great to throw a lot of money at the education system, and we can keep throwing money at the education system, but I'm wondering how we can blindly go down that path without any fiscal integrity on the part of our education partners locally, and how can we ensure that they're utilizing the money to our best benefit as opposed to wasting. And I can give you an example. More recently, there was a consent item at the school board whereby, with a motion of a consent, no public input, there was $750,000 worth of approved spending that was done on a consent item, of which $100,000 were for a conference. When we have all of this money being wasted, and, you know, give an example like the GSA with the federal government, how do we ensure that?
I had the same questions. In fact, I got an email this morning about class size amendments and how that was being funded, and how do we reconcile what we as a state think we're giving the county and what the county thinks they're getting. And we're at the point now, I think, when Chair Calderon and I talk about once a week, where we just start laughing. The difference in information that we have from the state to the county is can sometimes be pretty enormous. I don't know that we're wasting money at the county school board yet, but I do want to dig in because that's why I filed that amendment. I just want to make sure the numbers that we're hearing are the correct numbers from our side, the ones that we're giving. Senator Simmons has worked exceedingly hard the last 2 years, and because of Florida's balanced budget amendment, we can't give any more money than we take in. And if we had more money, I know we all would love to give it towards education. But I want to make sure, and now we're completely tuned in. I mean, after this last session, I think Chair Calderon and I talked probably every other week, if not every week, to try and dial into what exactly was happening. And some of these issues that you brought up are the ones that I think this summer we're going to be taking a good hard look at to see how can we get the best for our kids, because we want more time for phys ed. We want more hours in the day if we can. We'd love to be able to pay teachers more. We'd love to be able to do all these things. We just have a finite amount of resources to do it. So let's make sure it's the most efficient spend.
And I will point out to you that if you look across the nation, Florida spends approximately $8,000 per student, per pupil. That is 33rd in the nation. We're not wasting money on our children. While we may be 11th or 5th in the nation overall in every aspect, we are 33rd with respect to the amount we spend on children. There are other states that spend $12,000, $13,000, $14,000, even $15,000 per student, and they still don't do as well as we do. In other words, your school district here, for example, is doing a phenomenal job based upon the challenges that they have. And let me tell you why Seminole County is having the financial difficulties it's having. One of the reasons is because 3,900 children have left the school system in the last 5 years. In other words, you're now in a situation where you have like almost, what, a couple of high schools and several elementary schools less lost in this state. Why? It's because, I suspect, not only the economy, but people have left the suburbs to move more to downtown in order that they can not have to spend so much on gasoline and things like that. In other words, Seminole County has had to face a significant challenge that other communities, other districts have not had to face. I've got, of the 67 school districts, the 67 counties in the state of Florida, we have counties that have increases in student population. Seminole County has had a significant reduction in its student population, which has therefore reduced the amount of funding that is received by Seminole County because, remember, constitutionally, funding is based upon the number of students that you have. And when you have a reduction in the number of students, you have a reduction in your amount that you receive. So Seminole County's got some significant challenges that the school board has had to address as a result of that.
Okay, we've got time for about one more.
I'm Marilyn Hockman. I'm an attorney, and I have four children. Two of them are at colleges in this state. One's at the University of South Florida. One's at the University of Florida. And Senate Bill 1752 just got passed, and House Bill 7129, and it's getting ready to go to the governor. President Machen from the University of Florida is meeting with the governor before the governor's going to sign it. And you're talking about how wonderful Seminole County and Florida is in getting up and doing all these educational things, and that's great from kindergarten through 12th grade. But what about their, you know, bright futures? I mean, that's gone. What about, this is all about the tuition hikes. And how are those kids going to afford to go on to the college level if you guys are agreeing that University of Florida and Florida State University, they're going to have a 17% raise in their tuition? So isn't there another way that you can do this instead of putting it on all the kids?
Thanks for your question. I think we all want to talk on this one. We all get fired up about this as much as I think everybody in the community does. What I'll tell you is that we've had to reform Bright Futures. You know, as standardized testing maxes have gone up, we've not kept up with the proportional number of standards. As a result, in order to qualify for Bright Futures, you have to get an ACT score in the 49th percentile, which isn't a Bright Future. It's a statistically average future. So I think what's important there is that we acknowledge the fact that we may need to, in order to have students who qualify for this, because families are making financial decisions based on this. If you qualify for it, absolutely you should get it. I think the state needs to do a good job of bringing that standard up, which we've done. The other thing that's happened is that we have capped our university tuition in the state of Florida to a point where we're, what, 44th cheapest, 45th cheapest, somewhere in there. We're one of the cheapest places in the nation to go to school. What that means is that we don't have enough money to hire a lot of the brilliant researchers that would normally make top-tier schools more competitive. So as a result, we're losing ground to a lot of other schools in the Southeast that don't have, or in the country, that don't have that same kind of constraint. I think the bill you're referring to is the one that allows Florida State and the University of Florida to have market-based tuition, which will then allow them to be competitive with some of the other schools they want to compete with. If we keep the tuition artificially average, what we're going to do is attract artificially average, not artificially, actual average salaries that are commensurate with that, and we will guarantee that all of our universities in the state remain average. This bill allows that a handful of them can actually go and excel and compete in the marketplace, the global marketplace that we're in.
In looking at this bill, I think it is important that we don't handicap our major universities. I saw one study that of the top, I think, 60-some schools in the United States, University of Florida is the only one that ranks within this elite group. So by removing these caps on their funding, I believe that we'll get probably another school in that group in not too long. But I think the bigger picture, we talked a lot about job creation, the economy, to give our major institutions every chance that they can to be world-class universities even more so, really ties into what type of economy we want to have here. So I think that that's the on a more macro level. But again, I have one at each school, and I was comfortable voting for this.
I fully feel the pain of anyone who has to pay for the tuition for their children, but perspective is important. Florida is about the 45th and maybe even 47th in the nation with the most affordable. That means we're like number three in the nation for the most affordable schools, colleges, universities in this entire nation. And the disparity between us and other developed states is tremendous, tremendous. And take this into consideration. If the tuition here in the state of Florida is like $2,300 or $2,500 per student, you've got many students, and as a matter of fact, 95% of the students who go to University of Florida, Florida State, UCF, USF, 95% of them have a Bright Future scholarship. So we're therefore further paying for that. In other words, education, higher education in the state of Florida is one heck of a bargain. Do I not want to see it ever raised? Sure, I don't want to see it raised. But the fact of it is with the economy that we have, with the challenges that we have to make sure that we have good quality professors, because none of you want your children to go and have a first-class ticket to a second-class school, first-class ticket being that it's all paid by the state, and then you find out that you've got a second-class education. We don't want that. We know that we are number two, number three, maybe number four with the most affordable schools, colleges, universities in the nation. We don't want to raise it, but we felt like we had to make sure that we could compete.
Let's have a round of applause for our legislative delegation and thank them for all that they do.
You've been listening to three members of the Seminole County Legislative Delegation, Senator David Simmons, Representative Jason Broder, and Representative Scott Plakin. They've presented an update of the results of the 2012 session of the Florida Legislature. On this podcast webpage, we have provided web links to the official websites for each legislator, as well as photographs taken at the event. Links to additional podcasts produced by CMF featuring reports on the action of the Florida Legislature and these three Seminole County lawmakers are also provided on our webpage. We also encourage you to leave a comment about this feature or to email a link of this feature to persons you know who have an interest in the legislation that emerged from the 2012 session. While at the website, you may listen to an ever-expanding collection of gavel-to-gavel presentations from other community events featuring local issues and voices that matter, each presented in a manner that may not otherwise be available in a sustained or substantial form from local mainstream electronic media. And if you know of a local speaking event featuring an issue you believe is relevant to Central Florida and believe it to be appropriate for this series, let us know that too. Simply click on the contact link found on the site and write to us about it. And stay in touch too, won't you? Follow CMF on Twitter and Facebook. While you're on the site, please subscribe to CMF's free e-letter so we may keep you up to date on the programming and activities of Carroll McKinney Public Media. Likewise, please consider subscribing to the content using the RSS feature we provide for your feed reader or subscribe using iTunes. Once subscribed, you will be alerted immediately to each new presentation we post at Heard in Central Florida. While you're at the CMF Media website, peruse our archives for additional podcasts of interest about issues important to our community. CMF is a nonprofit, publicly supported charity. Ample information about CMF's budget, governance, history, and future plans may be found in the Transparency Document drop-down at the top of the homepage. Thanks for listening to Heard in Central Florida. I'm Desta Horner.
Support for Heard in Central Florida is made possible in part by the Friends of Carol McKinney, who encourage you to make a tax-deductible gift in support of the programming activities of Carol McKinney Foundation for Public Media. You may give online at cmfmedia.org, where you may also see a complete list of those friends in the donor section of our website.
Heard in Central Florida is a presentation of Carol McKinney Foundation for Public Media, Incorporated.
Visit cmfmedia.org for more information.
For Heard in Central Florida, this is Judith Dolores Smith.
And this is Michael Hominick.